Iran appears to pull back at the last minute from executing another two young men arrested during recent protests. A VOA Persian journalist joins us to explain how Iranians are mobilizing on social media and in real life to try to save the protesters' lives.
Now they use the hashtag Unity, in Farsi, Ittihad. This will help them to support each other, and they saw the result.
Plus, what impact has almost 4 months of protests had on Iran's Islamist rulers? We'll hear from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
They obviously are nervous about engaging in a great deal of violence in what you would call the Persian core of Iran.
And later in the program, as the U.S. sanctions Iran's oil industry, we'll find out why Tehran hopes petrochemicals will give it a boost. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Iran has drawn Western condemnation for its third and fourth executions of young men involved in recent protests. Authorities hanged Mohammad Mehdi Karami and Mohammad Hosseini on Saturday in Karaj for allegedly killing a Basij militiaman. Rights activists said the two men were tortured into confessing and were denied a proper defense in rapid trials. Iranian social media users later said authorities appeared to be preparing to hang two more male protesters in Karaj on Sunday. Rosita Irandust is a VOA Persian journalist. She spoke to me in the studio about what happened when those reports reached the men's families.
After Mohammad Qobadlu's father and mother heard the news, they went close to the Rajai Shahr prison.
They were outside.
And a lot of people gathered outside of the Rajai Shahr prison.
We saw
a
video of people
exactly,
protesting.
They start chanting. And the good news, that stopped the execution.
That's what some people are saying, that they believe that protest stopped an imminent execution.
Exactly. And the social media people, they said, look, this is how we say about the unity. If we all together, if we say something all together, we can do something. Now they use the hashtag unity, in Farsi, Ittihad. So this will help them to back to each other and support each other. And they saw the result.
So maybe they'll try to do it again.
Exactly. And right now, before I come to the for this interview, Atena Daimi, one of the political prisoners, he just tweeted that the government announced, we didn't want to execute these people. Look, that's work. So,
right, they're trying to deny the
exactly.
protesters a victory,
exactly.
it seems.
Exactly.
Right. Another big topic on social media, I think, has been the third anniversary of Iran's shoot down of the Ukrainian passenger plane, which killed 176 people. They were many Iranians and Iranian Canadians who were flying from Tehran to Kiev en route to Canada, and Iranian missiles shot the plane down 3 years ago. So
exactly.
What have people been saying about that?
That was really sad, because usually during the year, their family shared a picture, but especially a week before the anniversary, they start to just share their news and share their picture, especially Hamid Ismailioun, who just created Families of Victim organization, and they organize specially. That's why this week gathering in D.C. postponed it to Sunday to support their gathering and this third anniversary.
And you actually were at the protest here in Washington at the Lincoln Memorial on Sunday.
Yes.
And you know, at that protest, people were marking the third anniversary of this plane shootdown, as you
exactly.
mentioned. And also, they were denouncing the executions of the two young men on Saturday and chanting their names. And let's have a listen to a sound from that protest for a moment.
Mohammad Hosseini! Say his name!
Mohammad Hosseini!
Say his name!
Mohammad Ali Harami!
Say his name!
So, Rosita, What were your main observations from that protest that you went to? As you mentioned, Iranians here in the Washington area, they typically protest on Saturday, but this time they had their big gathering on Sunday because of this anniversary.
Michael, I can tell you all these things that happened looks like a chain together. No matter they chanting for no execution or to just support the third anniversary gathering in Canada or any other gathering or support the Iranian protesters in Iran, they need only one thing.
And what's
that? They need to grab the international attention to this situation. And because they want to say now people, they are for urgent action and they ask for urgent action. So they want to put the pressure to the world and to the leaders, keep tagging the news and keep tagging the leaders to tell them, look, they need your help. They are not alone. We are here. No matter it's cold weather or not, they're coming with the children. They're chanting, they're gathering. They usually gather close to the most important building in D.C., in White House, close to the White House, or any tourists area, same as Lincoln Memorial, or another place they usually go, Freedom Plaza, because the name of Freedom Plaza is really important.
It's symbolic.
We have it in Iran, it's symbolic. So the only thing they need the leaders' attention, and that's it.
It does look like they are getting a lot of attention. Rosita Iran-Dust, journalist with the VOA Persian Service, thank you so much for coming on to Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you.
Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei had harsh words for protesters on Monday. In a speech in Qom, he said ongoing protests were acts of treason and blamed them on Western Arab and Israeli incitement. Ruel Mark Gerecht is an analyst at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and a former Mideast specialist at the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. I asked him on the phone how the protests have affected Khamenei's power base.
I would say that the inner circle, those that are close to the supreme leader, I think there is a fair amount of unity in that, you know, they view this as a life and death struggle. Outside of that very small circle, amongst those who once upon a time were actually close to the supreme leader, I think there's a much greater divergence of views. It's unclear where this dissenting opinion would go. I mean, the advantage the regime has is that if this is a life and death struggle, and I believe it is, then the opposition, I think, is unlikely to accept, you know, former senior members of the clerical regime into any type of new order. I mean, this is an evolving situation, but it does appear that the protesters are after not reform, but actually the end of the theocracy, the end of the Islamic Republic as we have known it. Needless to say, anyone who has risen high in the Islamic Republic would be in danger in that new order.
So what options does that leave the close circle of people around the supreme leader in terms of how to move forward and keep themselves in power?
Oh, I think they're going to try to kill their way out of it. They're obviously not trying to do it in a comprehensive way. I mean, if you were to compare the way they have approached these demonstrations with, say, 2019, they've been actually less violent. And they obviously are nervous about engaging in a great deal of violence in what you would call the Persian core of Iran. Most of the casualties have occurred in the primarily ethnic provinces. Now, you have to be careful there because even in the ethnic provinces, there's a great deal of ethnic diversity. But certainly, the worst violence appears to have occurred in Kurdistan and Balochistan. But I think the regime has clearly decided that they're going to turn up the pressure. They're selectively executing people. It certainly appears they're engaging in more torture and violence against those who have been arrested. So they're trying to ratchet it up and to see whether fear will do the rest.
What is holding the Iranian government back from taking deadlier measures in the Persian population centers of the country?
I think the primary concern is that they could provoke mass demonstrations. I think there's a concern, certainly when it comes to women, that elite families, their own daughters are protesting. So you could find that daughters of the clerical elite, even the Revolutionary Guards, they could be, you know, killing their own daughters. So I think there's a real nervousness about too much violence in the Persian core. They really don't want to see mass demonstrations like they saw in the past in Tehran. So I think they're trying to, you know, nibble away at this with increasing violence on the edges to see whether, in fact, they can shock the system and basically get the dissent at least calmed down enough that they can, you know, operate the society adequately.
What can you say about the assessment of the U.S. intelligence community about the, you know, cohesiveness of the Iranian government right now?
Well, I don't know if the intelligence community has a great deal of insight into the cohesiveness. I think their view, to the extent that we can assess it from the outside, is that they don't believe these demonstrations are regime threatening. I don't think the regime thinks that way. I think they do think they're regime threatening. But obviously, the demonstrations have to increase in size and the frequency has to stay high. So yeah, the pressure will be on the dissenters to keep it up. Now, the advantage and disadvantage that the opposition now has today is that it is essentially leaderless. Now, that makes it difficult to organize the opposition, but it also makes it impossible for the regime to kill it off. You know, if the regime could locate actual leaders of the opposition, then you can rest assured that they would, you know, be in prison or be executed. So the pressure really is on the opposition, particularly young women, because that is what the regime is most scared of, is killing young women, to, you know, keep pressure on the streets, to keep the system convulsed.
Well, on that note, when you look at the images and details emerging from, you know, the Iranian streets in the last couple of days and weeks, how do you assess the ability of the dissenters to keep up that momentum?
Well, I mean, obviously they're keeping it up. I think things have died down from a few weeks ago. That seems clear. But again, I think you have to look at the long haul. I'm sure the regime is. So, you know, it may quiet down for a time. The regime may kill one person too many, torture somebody, some young woman may get raped in prison. And once again, you could provoke substantial demonstrations. So that's the game at play, is whether they can crack down sufficiently, have fear spread through society, and then the opposition, particularly young women, don't go back in numbers. And I think effectively the regime has compromised on the hijab issue. They're not going to make it official, of course, but effectively in much of Iran, the hijab has essentially fallen. That is certainly a tactical concession on the part of the regime and a realization that they don't have the forces to, it's not a good idea to enforce it. They may not have the numbers to do that. And, you know, they'll see whether that has any effect. Again, I'm skeptical that these tactical concessions will have any long-term value for the regime, in the sense that it's quite clear that a substantial number of Iranians, I would say it's over a majority, you know, want to end the theocracy and want the end of the Islamic Republic as we've known it. But, you know, going from that aspiration to the nuts and bolts of actually, you know, cracking the security services is a long distance. And obviously, if the security services don't crack, the Islamic Republic continues.
Well, Ruel Markgerecht, resident scholar at FDD, thank you very much for being on Flashpoint Iran.
My pleasure.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. Iran's rulers are increasingly relying on the production and export of petrochemicals to keep their government afloat. Petrochemicals are derived from crude oil, a natural resource that has long been Iran's main revenue earner. But Iran has seen that revenue fall since 2018, when the U.S. resumed sanctions on Iran's oil sector. Rachel Ziemba is an energy analyst at the Center for a New American Security. I asked her on the phone why petrochemicals have become so important for Tehran.
Petrochemicals, in a sense, are a way for Iran to leverage and add some value to the energy resources that it has, rather than just extracting and exporting crude oil or non-processed products. And it's been a major way to try to not only add value, but to make the best and cope with what would remain quite onerous sanctions.
What are the main uses of these petrochemical products that Iran is making, and who is buying them?
Yeah, so petrochemicals are used in a wide array of industrial uses. It's used as major inputs into plastics and other manufacturing. They also can involve products that are used in road construction and other things like that. You know, they're used also as an input into chemical and even fertilizer plants. So as with most of Iran's exports, these petrochemical outputs have mostly gone to China, but they've also gone to countries in the region, elsewhere in the Middle East. And you know, as I say, this has been a growing industry, in part siphoning off some of the, you know, sort of fuel that would previously have been exported. Also, some of these petrochemical outputs are being used at home, right? As it is difficult for Iran to purchase in and buy in sort of petrochemical inputs from elsewhere. Part and parcel of developing its own petrochemical and the refining industry as well was a reaction to the fact that if we go back 10, 15 years before this round of sanctions really sort of kicked off, Iran used to be reliant on imports of a lot of processed fuels and petrochemicals. So this has been a part of trying to increase their resilience to sanctions. Of course, given those sanctions and the export controls, the environmental impacts, the sort of, you know, efficiency of these plants is perhaps less than they would be, or the environmental impacts are higher and the efficiencies might be lower than they are in some of the peer countries.
You mentioned that China is a big customer for Iran's petrochemical exports. How is Iran getting these products to customers like China and to customers in its region, you know, compared to how it ships oil, for example?
Sure. So in some cases, it might be shipping oil and petrochemicals in a fairly similar manner. And if you look at the Chinese import statistics, which is a way that a lot of us track Iran's economy, what you see is that, you know, China doesn't report a lot of purchases from Iran, particularly sort of in oil or even petrochemicals. However, what they tend to do, they tend to import them indirectly through countries like Malaysia, even the UAE and the like. And so sometimes those cargoes are disguised and, you know, sort of come in directly through those hubs. There is a bit of a whack-a-mole game sort of going on with the U.S. authorities. You know, I imagine you guys have talked about this intermittent increased sanctions on the energy sector, which it would include petrochemicals. And about once a month since June of last year, there's been a wave of some companies added to the sanctions list, including some of those involved in petrochemicals.
What is it about the nature of petrochemical products that has enabled Iran to, you know, continue growing its markets for these products despite these increasing numbers of companies under U.S. sanctions, as you mentioned?
Yeah, so I think two factors. One is that typically when a country like, you know, Iran has had a lot of experience in coping with sanctions in the energy and other sectors. And so there's often, when there's money to be made, there can be shell companies and middlemen and intermediaries that come in. So even as companies get shut down, there are shell companies and other companies that sort of step in to continue on some of this trade. And I think some of this some of the U.S. enforcement actions, if we go back a few years, were more focused on oil and what are called condensates rather than some of the petrochemical products. So it's been a bit more of a gray area where petrochemical products are involved. I think that's something that could shift as the sort of U.S. government, you know, really continues to look for kind of a plan B of what to do now with the JCPOA not going anywhere.
That's the Iran nuclear deal.
That's the Iran nuclear deal, yes. But, you know, up until this point, I mean, they're, you know, looking to close off these loopholes. But this is also an industry that, as I said, some of the products are less subject to sanctions than, you know, as I say, products closer to oil.
Is that because some petrochemicals can actually be delivered, exported, not through tankers as Iran ships its oil, but actually in smaller cargoes, you know, delivered over land through trucks and rail? Is that a factor in this?
It is. And within petrochemicals, as you look at them, some of them are more liquid and some of them move more towards semi-solid. And so there are indeed, especially tanker structures that might be able to put on trains and the like. You know, it does really depend on what format. I mean, I will note that a lot of the energy and including petrochemical products that show up in China tend to be bitumen that usually, as it's defined, would involve a lot more solid matter. And then, of course, some of those products have to be then refined away. But yes, it can make it easier to transport.
Just to wrap up here, how do you see Iran developing its petrochemical industry in the coming year? And what obstacles does it face as it tries to keep growing this rather lucrative business?
Sure. So I do see there being a lot of commitment from Iranian authorities to grow this industry. There are some foreign joint ventures, mostly with the Chinese. I would probably be watching for any joint ventures that might involve the Russians. So that's not been a key focus as of yet. But given that the two countries are interacting more on an economic basis, they are, of course, competitors in this space. Some of the challenges, of course, involve the continued sanctions, the risks that it's rising. There is also domestic concern. I'm sure on your program you've talked a lot about labor unrest as well as the protests for other reasons and environmental concerns. We've continued to see a bit of a steady stream of worker strikes at petrochemical facilities, usually either looking for more wages or different kinds of compensation. There's also been some concern from environmentalists as any of the energy extraction itself involves more use of the energy, but may impact water sources. We know that Iran, of course, is very water poor, and that's a structural issue that is going to be there for some time. So these factors, I would say, are likely to sort of raise the costs and become a trade-off the Iranian government will be facing.
Something to definitely keep an eye on. Rachel Ziemba, adjunct senior fellow for the Energy Economics and Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, speaking to us from Vancouver, Canada. Nice to have you on Flashpoint Iran.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week's show. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next week for another Flashpoint Iran.